Okay, I'm going to try something here that's probably going to tempt fate. But I think it's worth trying. Could this be the final Reliable Sources podcast episode about COVID-19? Could this be it? Could this be the last time we convene guests here on the podcast and talk about the two-year-long pandemic? Maybe. Hopefully. I don't know, but that is one of the questions for this week's episode. Let's go ahead and get started. Let's cue the music. I'm Brian Stelter, and this weekly podcast is our chance to go more in depth, talking with media leaders and newsmakers about how the news gets made. And right now we're at this 2-year anniversary. For some reason, anniversary feels like the wrong word, but 2 years since the COVID-19 pandemic upended life as we knew it in the United States. It was 2 years ago, basically today. I'm taping this on March 10th. It was March 11th when life started to stop in the United States. I've seen March 11th described as the day everything changed. It was the day the NBA shut down its season. It was the day Tom Hanks tested positive. It was right around this time, 2 years ago, that everything grinded to a halt. And now it really feels like history when we look back at it. We've been through repeated surges, most recently with Omicron. We've been through waves of vaccination and boosting. We've been through so much unnecessary death and suffering. And maybe now we're coming out the other end. Maybe now this can be the final episode of this podcast about COVID-19. Or maybe we'll be back in a year or two talking about it again. I don't know, but I do know I have two experts with me. Who have fantastic insights about the last 2 years, about what went right and what went wrong, about trust in the media and trust in public health officials. Fantastic insights from Dr. James Hamblin and Dr. Elizabeth Rosenthal. So let me bring them in just a moment. Dr. Hamblin and Dr. Rosenthal were both with me on CNN right around this time 2 years ago. They were two of the final guests that I had in person on set talking about this looming pandemic. So I thought it would be interesting to revisit that with them. Dr. Hamblin is a lecturer at Yale, the School of Public Health there. He's the founder of The Body Newsletter. And Dr. Rosenthal is the editor-in-chief of Kaiser Health News and a contributing writer at The New York Times. So let's get to it. Dr. Rosenthal, welcome back to Reliable Sources.
Thanks, Brian, for having me.
And Dr. Hamblin, welcome back to you as well.
It's good to be here.
I think we're meeting in a much better way, you know, on a much better day now, 2 years later. But before we talk about where things stand and whether this will be my last pandemic podcast, Dr. Rosenthal, you and I were on March 8th of 2020. I remember right before bringing you in and talking, I used the words social distancing for the first time. I showed that famous XY axis, that graph where, you know, you try to suppress the case count in order to keep healthcare capacity online. You know, so we were learning those sorts of terms. The rest of us were learning the lingo that you've known for decades. So let's go back to that terrifying month, March 2020. What do you remember about that month, Dr. Rosenthal?
Well, I think there was tremendous uncertainty, and ironically or sadly, March 8th was the last day I saw my mom, who lived in an assisted living facility in New York and died of COVID a month later. So I think that just tells you, you know, how much uncertainty was in the air. It was at a moment where everything was starting to lock down, and the dominant strain of thought was just fear and the unknown. And you know, we're much better off than we are then, thankfully, after 2 years. But I would say we could be much better off than we are now if we'd done some things differently.
Right. But that day, March 8th, so you and I were on set that day. We were still allowed to have on-set guests at CNN. And then you were able to go and see your mom afterwards?
I was. And the next day, her facility shut down.
So you didn't know, obviously, on that day that it was your last time together.
Well, her birthday was 2 weeks later, and naively that day, they said they were going to do a, you know, one of these short-term closures, and I assured her that, oh yeah, in 2 weeks this is going to be over, and we'll hold your birthday party.
And I remember you wrote a piece of the Times shortly after she died that I still remember. We talked about it on television that it was important for people to know the human stories here, because as you wrote, you know, all of this was happening. Not, I won't say behind closed doors, because, you know, that conjures up secrecy, and this wasn't about secrecy, it was about safety. This was all happening inside hospitals and nursing homes where we couldn't really see the story.
Yeah, and that made it certainly harder and harder to cover. And for us at Kaiser Health News, the government didn't help. You know, one of our projects that first year was called Lost on the Frontline, where we were counting all of the healthcare workers who died due to occupational exposure. And I'm really proud of that project. It was over 3,600 that first year. But at some level, I stood back and said, wait a second, why are we doing this? Why isn't OSHA or the Labor Department doing it? Yeah. You know, there was just this absence of leadership, and it was really distressing.
You brought that up on our March 8th broadcast. You said the number of cases are going to rise dramatically because we're now starting to do the kind of testing that we should have been doing. And so you were telling people don't get alarmed right away just because cases are rising. You also said on that program, you said, we're talking about, you know, not getting into tight spaces, crowded spaces, maybe closing schools. So I just want to think back to that moment before we knew just how bad this was going to be, right? That on March 8, 2020, you're saying maybe we're going to have to close schools.
Yeah, and I had lived through SARS as a reporter in Beijing, right? So I had been through an experience of shutting schools, shutting stores, everyone wearing masks. But that was relatively short-lived, compared to what COVID turned out to be.
Right. Over to you, Dr. Hamblin. You and I spoke 1 week after the segment with Dr. Rosenthal. This was March 15th, 2020. We're still on set. This was the last week I was going to have guests on set. And I asked you, I said, is there enough social distancing happening right now? And your answer was basically, we should be leaning in the direction of overreacting, not underreacting right now. We should be playing it extremely safe, you said, because we're behind the ball in terms of testing other modes of preparedness. So when you think back to that month, what do you remember? What stands out to you, Dr. Hamblin?
Well, you know, I was just trying to be in solutions mode and help people understand, you know, that this was going to create a huge wave in New York and across the country, and that we needed to be better prepared. We needed to be testing. We needed to have policies in place. Specifically, it was right around that time that I wrote my first thing about, paid sick leave or universal basic income being, you know, extraordinary measures needed to be put in place so that people could stay at home, not gather. And I don't think we were thinking, you know, at a federal level at all.
No.
In that way at the time.
No, we weren't.
It was just kind of, I remember feeling like the opening scenes of a Jurassic Park movie, you know, where you like know that something is coming, but people are still going around living as if it weren't. And that's where we were.
And this was weeks after you wrote your, I don't know if I should call it famous or infamous, column for The Atlantic. The title is You're Likely to Get the Coronavirus. And you wrote that on February 24th, 2020. So nearly a month later is when the U.S. really quickly shut down, suddenly shut down. It wasn't quick. It was sudden.
Right.
You called it. You called it when Donald Trump was still comparing it to an impeachment hoax.
Yeah, I was quite nervous about running that headline, but I felt, as I said on the program to you later, that, you know, we needed to be prepared for this to spread widely, and there was no reason to think that it wouldn't. If you looked at the way it was spreading in other countries, there was the sense of American exceptionalism, like, oh, okay, well, it's happening in all these other places, but it couldn't happen here, right? Huh. And there was just no reason to think that. So, it seemed pretty clear that this was a respiratory virus like this. You know, there are models that had been predicting this for a very long time, and it was not revelatory to expect that this was going to spread as it has.
And you said on the program with me on March 15th, you said, Panic is never useful, but preparation is. It's time to prepare, not panic. And a lot of people listened, and a lot of people did do that. But now, 2 years later, I wonder what both of you feel you've learned about public health and communication. You know, are there ways that communication worked or really didn't work at that starting point in March 2020? Because it's almost as if that was the only time where maybe we were all listening to each other or listening to the same sources or were somewhat united, right? Wasn't there maybe?
Yeah.
Am I rewriting history when I say that there was a brief period where it felt like the country was united before we were all divided by COVID?
Well, I think, you know, part of the problem is the first year of the pandemic, there was like a communication vacuum. And so there were a lot of things filling that void, right? Partly because of who was in the administration and the way former President Trump was interpreting things according to his political needs for much of that first year. The other thing I think we saw that was so alarming is, and I know Dr. Hamlin has written about this, is that, you know, we treat public health on a county by county, city by city, state by state basis. So there wasn't a really good national health message. It was like whatever the local public health officials said was what went. And as we saw over the course of that first year, more than 100 of them quit because they were so undermined by the political leadership in their area.
I think there was a brief moment there of, as there is, you know, as you're seeing right now with the war in Ukraine, that there are brief moments where everyone comes together and there's a clear cause, and political lines sort of briefly start to fall away. But we didn't have the leadership in that moment to capitalize on that. And so we just had a bunch of mixed messages and confusion and promises about churches being open by Easter. And
I forgot about that, but now you're bringing me back.
Right.
Trump saying we're going to open the pews by Easter. Oh gosh.
Yeah. I think competent leadership in that moment really could have made a big difference. And some things started to happen, but then it quickly devolved into chaos and confusion.
I remember saying that weekend, we are all in this together. Remember when that slogan was everywhere? We're all in this together. But Dr. Rosenthal, was that ever actually true?
Well, not in our country. It wasn't, unfortunately. And you look at the reaction of places like South Korea, where they immediately jumped on this. There was a national plan. And the total deaths remain, you know, as we approach a million, I think they're still in the hundreds. So, you know, you see the impact that a quick national reaction can have to a new biologic threat.
So March 2020, what are the specifics, what specific steps should have happened that didn't happen, or what should have exactly happened differently?
Where do I begin? Well, we were very far behind the ball on testing. CDC's tests weren't working, and they were not working with people who could have accelerated the testing process. And that kept us totally in the dark. And so then we were reporting things like, we've found a fifth case of coronavirus. It's been reported in Oregon or wherever. You know, I don't remember exactly where the fifth case was. But by that point, you know, there were hundreds, if not thousands of cases. We weren't looking, and yet we were acting as if we were. And then messaging as though this is a very short-term problem. You know, we need you to stay at home, but it's going to be 2 weeks, or it's going to be by the end of the month, going to be by the end of next month. And instead of putting in place these lasting, you know, expectations that people, that would help people deal with this, and then systems that would, you know, allow them to, which means sustainable testing. They did get vaccination development underway very quickly, which is good. But did not, you know, the social supports were there, but on a temporary basis that required constant renewal, and people didn't have the certainty that they'd be there next month. And we still don't have them today. And already, you know, Republicans are trying to repeal or end a lot of the relief measures now, as if we have not learned anything 2 years later.
But I think there's a counter argument to, and I'm not sure I believe this, but let me try it out on you. Coming out in March 2020 and saying, 2 years from now, your two-year-old might still be wearing a mask in school. That I don't. If we had had a better sense of how this was going to go, would people have maybe just repelled and just given up and not even taken precautions? I don't know. What do you make of that?
Well, I mean, that was the reaction to my story. That I said, you know, you're going to get this virus and it's going to be with us for years. And that, you know, I think some people thought that I was advocating for like doing nothing. And that's not at all the case. I think what has made people so upset and angry and burned out is the constant resetting of expectations. And that if we could have said, and we didn't know it would be here for years, if we could say, we need to prepare for this, be here indefinitely. We may need to wear masks during surges in certain situations. Right now, it's really bad. So everyone just wear a mask and later we'll figure out, you know, how to be more strategic about that. I think that would have helped a lot of people, you know, understand, set expectations accordingly.
Right, right. Dr. Rosenthal, what do you say to that?
Well, I do think one of the problems at the beginning was, of course, people were, it was like the Hunger Games for masks, for food, for everything like that. We turned it into a competition with each other. And the fact that we domestically didn't have the supplies to effectively treat and deal with a public health emergency was a real I don't know how to even describe it. It was a catastrophe. The other thing I would say in agreeing with James is this, you know, testing was and has been a persistent problem throughout the pandemic, and it's a national shame. I mean, in December 2020, I have a friend whose kid is at university in England. She came home with rapid tests 18 months, you know, literally almost 18 months before we see the ready availability of rapid tests in the United States. So the fact that we couldn't test people early on with PCR tests, then PCR tests took so long to come back that they were useless, then we didn't have rapid tests. I mean, we've done great on the vaccination front, but preparedness involves testing. And I think what we've seen is that really has to have there has to be a national hand in that. You can't trust the market because the market responds way too slowly for the need. I mean, now we all have rapid tests delivered to our door, but the Omicron variant has passed. When we really needed them, they weren't here.
Yeah, the moment that I don't want to say the moment I gave up or moved on, but the moment that I really, like that moment in mid-December when it felt like everyone in New York City had Omicron. And there were 4, 5, or 6 day long waits for PCR tests. You throw up your arms. You give up on testing as an option. And when you see that happen nearly 2 years into this, you lose so much confidence and trust in the government. And that ultimately, is that the story we're going to tell our kids someday about COVID? That this was about a loss of trust, a loss of belief in the government, Dr. Hamblin?
I think that has been our central issue. If you look around the world, the countries that have, you know, had the least bad responses, it all revolves around social cohesion and trust in your government. And there's a lot of justified distrust right now, and a lot of you know, falsely stoked distrust for political and reasons of newsletter growth and punditry. But I think, you know, that's our chief challenge right now, as you've seen trust in public health agencies and science and the very concept of expertise just plummet. And, you know, we just need to rebuild it, because if we don't have that, you know, we're going to have future surges, we're going to have future pandemics. And that moment of, you know, everyone coming together around a cause that you mentioned, you know, at the beginning of this pandemic, we had at least a moment there where we were together. And I don't see that happening again. If there was a new coronavirus that we saw emerging somewhere, you know, tomorrow, there would be no moment like there was in March 2020.
Well, that's pretty scary. Dr. Rosenthal, are you equally pessimistic?
Well, I would add to that, it's mistrust in the politics and the messaging, but it's also, you know, here's my larger view, it's mistrust in the medical system. You know, many Americans are not treated very well by our healthcare system. So they don't have a doctor they trust. They don't have a hospital they trust. You know, we just saw a survey from Kaiser Family Foundation today that 10% of people out there have medical debt that they can't pay. So, you know, they're not inclined to trust trust the health system when it says you should get vaccinated. And we would be in much better shape than we are today if there weren't these large pockets of unvaccinated people in the U.S. I mean, yes, we will eventually get there with herd immunity and natural immunity, but it takes much longer when there's this huge segment of the population that doesn't get vaccinated. And we're still seeing 1,300 deaths a day. That's just tragic at this point in the pandemic.
And you wrote in your piece in May 2020 mm-hmm. about your mom, written for The New York Times, which I mentioned earlier, you wrote about how her death was not counted as a death from COVID-19, yeah. right? Tell us what happened. On the death certificate, it was the secondary cause was listed as suspected right. COVID-19, right? But she almost certainly died of COVID. So we have undercounted the real loss in this country.
Yeah, we've almost certainly undercounted. And that was because at that point in the pandemic in New York, hospitals were so overwhelmed that unless you were admitted to the hospital, you didn't get one of those rare COVID PCR tests that were available at the time. And she was 96 at the time. We didn't want her hospitalized. She wasn't suffering unduly. She was fading before she got COVID. So because she didn't want to go to the hospital and be put on a ventilator, she couldn't get the test. But she had all the signs on X-ray, and there was COVID in the assisted living facility she was in, actually through no fault of their own. It was there before they even knew, because as James said, there wasn't widespread testing. So, you know, it's just sad.
And 2 years later, how are you doing coping?
Oh, fine. You know, having been double vaxxed and boosted and had my breakthrough infection now, you know, the world feels much more normal, but it's been very traumatic for everyone in different ways. You know, my newsroom has been operating virtually for 2 years. Everyone has experienced the suffering of this pandemic in his or her or their own way. And so much of it feels unnecessary. Had we had a strong national response and vaccination campaign and unity about when to mask, when to social distance. And we did a whole lot of crazy things like saying bars can stay open, but schools have to close. You know, where are our priorities? I think I had steam coming out of my ears at so many points during this pandemic.
Or when we closed playgrounds, outdoor playgrounds, even as it became clear that it was much safer to be outside than inside. Dr. Hamblin, do you have examples like that, that just like grind your gears?
Oh, man. Yeah. And I remember writing, April or so, don't close the park. They were closing down parks, you know, and it was like I said, don't close the parks, open the streets. And surely unrelated to any writing that I did, places did open streets and they continue to open streets. And I hope that we continue to focus on, you know, the importance of public spaces, outdoor public spaces. That's something that I'm going to continue to, advocate and focus on in my own practices. And I hope that doesn't mean just because some guidelines were wrong that everyone loses faith that that most people working in that area are in public health are well-intentioned and trying to keep people safe. But the fact is we are so behind the ball on the basic things that we knew we needed to be able to do, like providing masks and tests and giving people paid sick leave and shelter and medical care, that politicians invented sort of other things that they could show that they were doing, like closing down the parks, because they had to be doing something, right? And that was really regrettable.
Well, something that grind my gears, so it's a better expression than that, but like something that really gnawed at me throughout this was the talk of safe or unsafe. Like, whereas it was always much more of a spectrum, right? It was always, you're making choices that are safer or perhaps less safe. You're exposing yourself to more risk or less risk. I wish there had been more talk 2 years ago about, you know, risk management or what's the term? Is there a term for that in public health about the amount of risk you're taking when it comes to a virus?
I wrote a column about that for the Times, that you really have to assess your personal risk tolerance.
When, tolerance.
And,
that's
and
the
you
word.
Know, every physician understands this when you work in an emergency room, as I did, when you go into a room with someone who may have multi-drug resistant TB. You kind of play it by ear. But I think, you know, and we did see, you know, certain people who were wiping down packages and magazines and every letter, and other people who were acting as if nothing was, you know, there was no problem. So there are genuine limits at which risk tolerance becomes irrelevant. There are facts involved in this pandemic, which one should respect. But some of it does have to do with, you know, are you around people who are vulnerable still? Because many people can't get vaccines or immunocompromised. What's your likely risk of getting serious disease if you get sick? I mean, it is a spectrum. So I do think that that was one problem. The other problem was the political narrative of people flip-flopping. People kept saying, oh, Dr. Fauci, he flip-flops. Well, you know, science evolves. Over these 2 years, we've understood so much more about this virus. And so, you know, updating your recommendations based on new knowledge is not flip-flopping, it's being smart. And somehow it wasn't conveyed that way.
I should have known that Fauci would become this hate object of some conservatives. I wouldn't have imagined that 2 years ago, but I should have seen it coming. What, Dr. Hamblin, what should you have seen coming? And then let's ask Dr. Rosenthal as well. What did you never expect would happen that ended up happening through this? You can say you expected everything. You can say you totally predicted it all, Craig.
I didn't predict all from the beginning, but I don't think there's anything really this, you know, it's been said many times before, but the pandemic revealed the problems that were already here. And that people much smarter than I predicted that this would happen. And if you, you know, just pay attention to history and read back, there wasn't anything here that was unpredictable. I guess the degree to which you would have incompetence at the federal level in the heat of an emergency and in such bad messaging was, you know, astonishing. But I think that's what really broke everyone's model of how pandemic response could go. But beyond that, I don't know. I forget what things were like before the pandemic.
Dr. Rosenthal, anything that really surprised you?
Yeah, absolutely. I thought once vaccines, well, first of all, that vaccines were developed so quickly. I didn't expect that. And that once they were developed, a whole segment of the population didn't want to get them. And that surprised me because this was one of the things, maybe one of the few things you could say that the Trump administration did an amazing work on during the pandemic. We got vaccines really quickly, got them widely available. You know, the Trump administration did this, and yet we saw that his base didn't want to get these things. It made no sense to me whatsoever.
I have to take a break in a moment, and we'll come back for more after that. But I wonder, is this going to be the sort of historic experience that we're all just never going to talk about again once it's passed? Because it was too traumatic, it was too painful, it exposed too many gaping wounds in our society. Like, do you think, Dr. Rosenthal, we're going to talk about and reminisce about this period, or will this become, like, will this become something we try not to remember?
Oh, I think we're going to be talking about this for a long time, like 9/11. It's going to be, where were you during the pandemic? And I hope, as journalists, part of our job is to make sure that people don't forget the lessons we should learn from this, which are mostly about public health and how we've let our public health system decay into a terrible, terrible state.
All right, more on those lessons in just a moment here on the Reliable Sources podcast.
This podcast is supported by Sleep Number. Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores? Sleep Number does that. Only Sleep Number Smart Beds let you each choose your ideal comfort and support, your Sleep Number setting. Sleep Number Smart Beds learn how you sleep and provide personalized insights to help you sleep better. All Sleep Number smart beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. Temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
I'm Dr. Sanjay Gupta, CNN's chief medical correspondent. This week on Chasing Life...
I'm sorry that the Great Barrier Reef is no longer great, that we value Amazon much more than the Amazon, and that the waterfront neighborhood where you were growing up could be condemned by rising seas before you're old enough to apply for a mortgage.
That's my friend Bill Weir, CNN's chief climate correspondent. He's optimistic about the planet, and he's optimistic about our ability to take care of it. Listen to Chasing Life, wherever you get your podcasts.
We're back on the Reliable Sources podcast. I'm Brian Stelter, speaking with Dr. Elizabeth Rosenthal and Dr. James Hamblin. 2 years since the pandemic upended everything in the U.S., practically two years to the day. So let's go back to that idea, that question I presented at the beginning of this episode, that maybe this will be the final podcast episode about COVID-19, that maybe this is the last time I'll be gathering guests to talk about this virus. Dr. Hamblin, is that possible? Am I tempting fate by asking that?
I think we should address that prediction in 2 years when we are doing our next podcast appearance with you. No, I think, it's difficult to predict the course of this virus, but it's not going away. And there will be, at the very least, future surges. And that's what's going to make it difficult. And hopefully, command a lot more attention, because there are moments of sort of moral clarity when there are terrible surges, as we just saw with Omicron. Everyone cares a lot about it and wants to talk about it. It's a leading news story. And then, if we have smaller surges in the future where you still could have, say 1,000 Americans dying every day. I'm, making that number up. I'm not predicting any particular number. But just because it's smaller than it's been in the past doesn't mean it's nothing, and it's going to be actually harder to navigate what's to be done about that, because people will have less will to take precautionary measures, and there'll be more interesting debates, and things will probably get more politicized. So, yeah, no, not the last time. I hope that you talk about this. Unfortunately, I wish it were.
Dr. Rosenthal, what do you say?
Well, I think it will slowly, hopefully, I'm an optimist, so I think hopefully subsequent surges will be less and less. I do remind people that the plague lasted for a century, I believe, coming back in waves. Now, of course, there wasn't a vaccine for that, but, these things can persist for a very long time. Now, I just hope when we talk about it in future, it will be how do we use the armamentarium that we've developed? How do we prevent it from surging in a big way again? And hopefully there won't be another, serious variant that emerges in one of these waves. Otherwise, we can, it can be starting from scratch all over again. So I hope it doesn't recede too much into the background. I hope we don't stop talking about it completely.
And am I too much of an optimist to feel that Omicron burned through everyone in December and January, so we are all relatively safe now?
I think that's exactly what you're seeing right now. Between the combination of vaccination and infection-acquired immunity, cases have plummeted. But we also know that immunity wanes, and we know the virus mutates. So depending on the degree to which that immunity wanes and how the virus mutates, that will determine when we'll have our next surge and how bad it will be. And we don't know whether, if the virus continues to cause a milder disease and we have, immunity years later that persists and protects us from, say, most people from serious illness and death, then that's a totally different world compared to if the virus mutates another direction and our immunity wanes to a degree that is really significant. And then we're back in a very, very bad place.
Let me try something out on both of you, and I'm probably going to butcher this question, and it's probably not a fair question, but let's try for fun. What worries you more, Dr. Rosenthal? What worries you more? Is it the folks who have refused vaccination and pretended like COVID doesn't exist and, you know, cough on each other at the airports or whatever? Or does it worry you more the folks who are still incredibly fearful and wanting to stay at home and not wanting to reengage with the world around them?
To me, I think you have to take a precautionary approach to this. So, you know, if people want to be overly cautious, that's their choice. And I respect that. I do think they should have their kids back in school. I do worry more about the people who are not vaccinated, who think they have immunity, who may or may not, because as Dr. Hamblin said, it wanes and maybe they didn't get Omicron. And those pockets are still places where COVID can breed new variants. So I worry much more about them. And they are the ones who will die. And I know there's this attitude of, oh, well, they chose not to get vaccinated, so they're bad. I'm not there yet. And I do think if any one of us is vulnerable, all of us remain more vulnerable.
Dr. Hamblin, what do you say?
I could never fault someone for being too cautious. In everyone has their own things they I don't know, neuroses, you could say, areas where we like to be particularly cautious. People who do things just, you know, because it makes them feel safer. And there's just no reason to fault someone for that. What I worry about is certainly people who are, you know, have a bad relationship with those feelings, are feeling, you know, extremely anxious over things that are clearly safe and don't want to be feeling anxious and wish they could go out, but have, you know, post-traumatic stress from losing loved ones, from getting extremely sick themselves, and are sort of reliving that nightmare every time they do basic things, which they should be able to be assured are, you know, safe now. And like you said, the safe versus unsafe is tough to say.
That's where I'm at.
Almost never get to 100%, but you can get to 99.99. And ideally people, you know, can do important things at that level.
That's where I am. I'm worried about folks who maybe they're relying on outdated information, whatever it could be, aren't able to make those risk assessments in a way that's, that's based on data and reality. And I read columnists like David Leonhardt, who has become quite controversial on this subject. And I feel like he's writing for them, meaning for folks who are maybe wary of stepping back out into the world. But then whenever we start talking about this, we then immediately have to remember there are folks who've been through severe trauma, as you said, who became extremely sick, who saw so many people die, who were maybe immunocompromised or have other concerns that are related. So we're in this environment where everybody's gone through it, but in a different way. Everyone's coming out of this a different person. And we don't know everyone's full story when we're reengaging with them. Do you think that's a fair assessment?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. This has become so complex. And not to mention, you know, specifically in your sphere, this fragmented information ecosystem, you don't know what people are reading, what they're hearing, where they've been told certain things, how it's been reinforced. And so it's really hard, you know, to judge anyone individually.
Right.
But I think there's a lot of work to be done to correct, you know, the information landscape. And it's in an ideal world, you would say, okay, that person is making a judgment call based on the same set of facts that I'm seeing. And we don't even know that to be true.
You're writing a piece of the Times right now about lessons learned 2 years later. And one of them is about the media. One of the points you want to make is about the media. What does, you know, hit you? What's most important to say 2 years later about trust in the media or lack of trust in information sources?
Oh, man. Well, I think you've seen a decline in trust of CDC and public health generally, dramatically over the course of the pandemic, and things have become very politicized, and it's, you know, public health and politics are inextricably linked. But I hope that we can, you know, in trying to rebuild that trust, one of the important things is to establish, sort of like in journalism, you have a firewall public health officials and politicians can work together and they listen to each other and, you know, they're on the same team, but they don't always have to be saying the same thing. They don't always have to, you know, have a unified message, and people can believe in public health data, can believe in the basic facts, can believe, you know, that if our CDC says, hey, a new variant is concerning in X country and we might get a surge this summer, that 100% of Americans should believe that, you know, and we should be able to disagree over what to do about it, exactly what policy should be in place. But we shouldn't have half the country saying, oh, I don't think there's actually a new variant.
Well, here is the easiest prediction I can make about the future of COVID-19. If that happens this summer and there's a surge, the prevailing right-wing media narrative will be, this is an attempt by Democrats to try to steal the midterms. I mean, guaranteed, like that will be the narrative. It will be, they're trying to reimpose restrictions. They're trying to change the way we vote this fall. I mean, I can already hear it in my ears.
Right, right.
That is the media, that's the info war environment that we're in. And if anything, the pandemic's made it worse, not better.
That is my fear, exactly. And there's just so much work to be done to build up a voice for CDC, for public health, where at least we can have a credible source for that fact and allow the pundits and politicians to debate motives and whatever about the policies that are in place. But American people can at least have the basic facts so they can develop opinions about that in a plane of reality.
But we have to do that in the context of a CDC that's been diminished and a public health workforce that's been severely diminished before the pandemic and during the pandemic. Something like 200 state and local public health leaders either quit, retired, or were fired during the pandemic, often because they were threatened, you know, and with violence by their constituents, the people they were charged with protecting. So there's a lot of work to do in this.
It's become a cliche that the pandemic accelerated lots of trends, but sure seems true. What other trends do you think it accelerated, Dr. Rosenthal, or which ones stand out to you the most?
I think for good and for bad, it accelerated things like virtual work and telemedicine. And I worry now that, of course, we will keep it all when we should keep what's useful and go back to in-person where it's more useful. So that's one big trend. Another thing I think, which is really important and good, is that, you know, Americans were long kind of stalwarts. You were supposed to go to work even if you were sick. Now, I think companies, including my own, have paid sick leave, which is really, really an important innovation for not just for COVID, but for infectious disease in general.
I'm glad you brought that up. My 4-year-old had the sniffles the other day and wanted to stay home from school. And of course, she stays home from school now, as opposed to, you're right, a couple of years ago, people made different choices when it comes to kids or grown-ups going to work. So you mentioned you've been remote at work for 2 years. What's your plan, if there is one, for going back into the office, at least at points?
Well, now we've had plans to go back into the office so many times now, I can't count. But our plan now is in early April, we're going to go back into the office 3 days a week in person, and we're all going to be there the same 3 days. And then Mondays and Fridays, we can work virtually. And we'll see how that goes. I do feel like some of the idea generation and collaboration, and especially nurturing of young journalists, is very hard to do remotely. So I think after 2 years, we're all going to be thrilled to be back in the same room.
Yeah. Yeah. We have a version of that CNN where most people are going to be coming back 3 days a week, maybe some more, maybe some less. But 3 days a week is that new normal. What about you, Dr. Hamblin?
Well, like so many people during the pandemic, I moved to freelance. So I'm going to be teaching in person starting this month in New Haven. But other than that, I don't have an office to go back to.
I love that you say in New Haven instead of saying Yale.
Oh, yeah.
That was very casual. A lecturer at Yale University. I've been teaching this semester at NYU in person, but with masks. And very curious to see what they do about masking now that the public schools are lifting the rules. But, you know, I guess that reminds me that we are still in an in-between.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we've been through so many phases of this. And now a lot of the rules are being lifted and a lot of the restrictions are being lifted. But we're actually still in an in-between phase of this pandemic. At least in some ways. And going back to work 3 days a week is kind of another example. Going into the office, I mean, it's kind of another example of that.
Right.
Where we may not know how Like you said, maybe we'll have to come back in 2 years and we'll know what's normal and what's not.
Yeah. You know, I just hope that people keep an open mind and are not judgmental of people who feel very differently or have very different risk factors and, you know, different family situations and whatnot. And some people will be really eager to come back into the office and other people will not. And I don't think that we need to rehash everyone's motives or decide whose are valid and whose aren't. You know, certainly during this period, I think everyone's are valid. Open-mindedness, I think, is the key.
Respect. Yeah. What a concept.
Yeah.
Dr. Rosenthal, last word to you.
Yeah, I hope everyone's gotten more used to wearing masks as a former physician. You know, you get used to it and you can have plenty of meaningful communication through a mask. It's not as good as communicating without one, but it's much better than sitting in your bedroom. So if we need to put them back on at times, I think people should do that. And it's not a big deal.
I will check in with you in a year or two, and we will see if this is the final pandemic era episode of this podcast. Yeah. Thank you both for chatting today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Brian.
And thanks, everyone, for tuning in for this episode of Reliable Sources. We'll see you on TV this Sunday, 11 a.m. Eastern Time on CNN. Make sure you're on the list for our nightly newsletter as well. Sign up for free, ReliableSources.com. And thank you for tuning in.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
You can now watch CNN's Five Things on Max. Each weekday, Kate Baldwin breaks down the five essential news stories in 5 minutes or less. She'll get you up to speed and on with your day. CNN's Five Things with Kate Baldwin, streaming weekdays exclusively on Max.